and welcome to We Are History. I'm Angela Barnes, and with me in the studio is comedy writer and history nerd, John O'Farrell.
Hello, Angela. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to be here.
It's really going to confuse new listeners. What's going on? John, you've chosen this week's subject, haven't you? And it was quite a conscious choice to go for something, let's say, a little bit lighter, wasn't it?
Yes. So far in this series, I have chosen The Race for the Atomic Bomb, which ends with the death of 100,000 people of Hiroshima. Then I did the Haiti Slave Rebellion, which was so bloody and brutal that, frankly, I'm not surprised there's never been a sitcom about it.
So this week, John, you've chosen, and I want to stress that, you've chosen to do nudity. Is that right?
That is right, yes.
I mean, how did you research that? Did you just type nudity into Google and see what popped up?
No, Angela. I read an academic book on the subject because that is the sort of serious historical researcher I am. The book is called A Brief History of Nakedness by Philip Cargom. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting from a sociological and historical point of view.
Yes, John.
I did not choose the subject for cheap laughs or schoolboy giggles. I studied the history of nakedness and nudity, and they're different things, because I'm very interested in social history and how attitudes evolve. But I will say this book has got colour photos and you can see everything.
You're such a smutty little boy. There it is. 2 minutes in, he's already reverted to being a 12-year-old. And we've already done a very specific episode on nudity, haven't we? Some people are going to say we're obsessed, John.
Well, maybe. Yes, it was the very first episode we ever recorded, actually, Angela, and it was on nudity in communist East Germany, which I think sort of set the tone for the following 100 episodes, really, because Angela got to talk about East Germany and the Cold War, and I got to do loads of jokes about bare bottoms.
It was both of us playing to our strengths, I think that's fair to say.
It was.
So what's different then, John, about this episode? Why are we back to people with their kit off?
Well, apart from me wanting a break from everyone killing one another, I saw this image of a sculpture of Napoleon from when he was Emperor of France and ruler of most of Europe, and it was in the nude. And I just thought, is that what he wanted? It just shows you how much attitudes change. Imagine today if they commissioned a sculpture of Rishi Sunak and he was in the nuddy and you could see his little willy peeking out.
Oh, stop it.
It's not something you want to dwell on, is it? Rishi Sunak's willy.
Stop making me think about it.
You're thinking about it again now, Angela, aren't you?
Yeah, it's not sort of nakedness not really associated with strength and power now, is it? I mean, maybe it was a big misunderstanding with Napoleon. Maybe he ordered a classical Roman-style statue of himself, and this is just what came back, and he's too mean to pay for it to be redone. I mean, it wasn't flattering, was it?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't thought about the willy at all since then. But it reminds me, when I was at university, my girlfriend was studying art, and she asked me if I would do a nude portrait, if she could, you know, paint me naked. And I said, okay, no problem. And I stood there in this student flat, and she did this live painting of me. I didn't think any more of it. And then she had a degree show and everyone was there with their glass of wine and the cheesy pineapples looking at all her paintings. And that is how I met her parents.
No.
It's like, oh, yeah, with them looking at a picture of me in the nude.
Oh, there it is, my daughter. Oh, no.
Yeah. That's her, but, you know, it's her mum looking me up and down going, okay, well, all right.
That reminds me of when I was a student nurse and I had to go for a smear test. And because I was a student nurse, obviously, I knew that it's important for students to be able to see medical procedures. So the nurse in my local GP practice said, do you mind if I have a student come in? I said, no, that's fine. And of course, I completely forgot that my GP practice was in exactly the same area where I was training. So just in walked one of my mates. I was like, oh, no, not you. No, get out. You can't see it.
That's too much.
Yeah. So going back to the episode, how far back has your research gone? I mean, Adam and Eve, very famously in the nude, weren't they?
Apart from the odd fig leaf, yes. And their nakedness, of course, was a symbol of their innocence. It was only after Eve tasted the apple of knowledge that they felt the shame of their nakedness and had to quickly find some clothes from lost property. And their shame has sort of set the tone for thousands of years when they went from naked to nude. So, Angela, you're the linguist. Explain the origin of those two words for me.
Well, the word nude comes from the Norman French, And the word naked comes from the German. Nacht is German for naked.
Right.
And as is so common in our lovely, wonderfully rich language, they mean subtly different things. Naked is sort of innocent and just being one's original self, whereas nudity is more of a statement. It's a choice to be nude. And for most of history, that choice is quite a provocative one, really.
Yeah. So we don't really know when humans started covering themselves up. The historical evidence from 1960s dinosaur films is that cavemen wore mammoth skin boxer shorts and the women all had furry wonder bras.
Yeah, I'm not sure how accurate that Raquel Welch film is, John. Just in terms of using it as historical research source. There were no dinosaurs and humans at the same time, John. Remember?
Don't be so sure, Angela. Don't be so sure. Look at the Flintstones. You can't argue with that. In fact, the earliest possible evidence for clothing in ancient humans is stone tools found at archaeological sites in Spain and Germany, which may have been used to prepare animal hides. There, I skipped the difficult
I've got
name.
To tell the listeners what just happened then, because I'm laughing too much. So that's the second time John's taken that paragraph, because in the first time he named the places, and you actually did a very good job of it, John.
Thank you.
But I know you've lost confidence, so you've decided just to say Spain and Germany instead. Fair enough.
I'm just not
Fair
a linguist.
Enough.
You're the linguist. You're the linguist, Angela. So anyway, yes, 780,000 years ago is the first evidence.
Wow. So, and actually, if you listen to our episode on the origin of Homo sapiens, you'll find out more about that period and probably the same jokes about the Flintstones that John's made in this episode, because neither of us can remember what we said yesterday, let alone in any previous episodes. So other evidence that they have from the fossil record is that, and this is pretty grim, that clothing lice began to diverge from head lice about 170,000 years ago. So that's a nice way of looking at it, isn't it? There had to be clothing then because the lice diverged. Lovely.
Yeah, I didn't actually occur to me there was a difference. I don't think we've ever had clothing lice in our family. We had the whole head lice thing in the kids' hair when they were at school.
Oh, yeah.
And there's always one bloody hippie parent who was like, oh, we don't use chemicals in our children's hair. We use natural herbs.
Yeah, she's given my kids lice again.
Exactly. There was one time I remember where the Jackie and I were both squatted over our two kids, just really painstakingly looking for these tiny, tiny lice. And I said to Jackie, oh, is this one? What she didn't know is that I put a 4-inch-long plastic praying mantis on top of Freddie's head. And she just said, hang on, let me look. And she looked across and went, ah, leapt out of her skin. This giant monster. It was funny at the time.
Being married to you sounds like a lot of fun, John, I have to say.
It's crazy.
Jackie's a lucky lady.
Oh, what laughs we've had.
So the need for covering up your nakedness at this point must have been just a practical necessity, I suppose, to keep out the cold as the old ice age is advancing.
Yeah, it was like, furs are in, they're the height of fashion, because otherwise you freeze to death.
Yeah. And in fact, it's thought, isn't it, that we might have nicked the idea of wearing furs off the Neanderthals.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all borrowed clothes off our mates and then accidentally forgotten to return them, haven't we?
Exactly. Oh, have I still got your Brontosaurus skin jacket? Oh, I'll drop it round. I definitely won't forget to do that.
Except it wouldn't be Brontosaurus, John, because dinosaurs were not around at the same time as humans.
Well, that's what you say. My sources say otherwise. Anyway, other things that anthropologists believe we used to cover our bodies were leaves, weird, tree bark, even weirder, and woven grass.
Uncomfortable, if nothing else.
Yeah, scratchy, yeah. I mean, it sounds stupid now, but it was fashionable at the time. And all fashions are a bit daft, you know, when you look back.
Yeah, it's no weirder than flares, is it, when you think about it?
No, exactly. Flared woven grass, there's something. By around 40,000 years ago, we were using needles and awls made out of bone and stone to create sewn-fitted clothes to keep us warm.
But, John, this isn't a history of clothing, is it, this episode? Well, that could be an interesting one to do one day. This episode's about attitudes to nakedness, so how that changed and evolved. And we really don't know where and when covering our bodies went from being a practical necessity for keeping out the cold to becoming a sort of social requirement. When did the very first dad take off his fur pants and his teenagers go, oh, dad, that's disgusting?
Well, I mean, you know, in terms of the written record, we have the Book of Genesis, which was probably written about 3,500 years ago.
I didn't know Phil Collins was that old.
Oh!
Oh, couldn't resist it.
You're on fire.
Oh.
And that is when the whole sort of modern Judeo-Christian notion of covering the shame of your nakedness probably got started in Western culture. Mm. It was only when Adam and Eve acquired knowledge, as I said at the beginning, that they looked at one another and there was something like, oh, I'm naked. This is so embarrassing. There's another Hebrew text, actually, from the time that says, he who stands naked by a lamp will be an epileptic, and he who cohabits by the light of the lamp shall have epileptic children.
What?
So... bad luck if you had epilepsy back then. You can blame your parents for cohabiting by the light of a lamp.
And when they say cohabit, they mean shagging, right? So that's their way of going, don't do it with the lights on, your pervs. That's what that
exactly.
is, or your kids will get epilepsy. Jesus.
Yeah, so... So, you know, the ancient Jewish were pretty prudish about nudity, and the Christian tradition sort of comes in a direct line from this attitude. That said, a Jewish baptism would have been done in the nude, so Jesus would have been naked when he got a ducking by John the Baptist.
Ah.
And the Jews were appalled by the immodesty of the Greeks and their tendency towards nudity.
Oh, yeah, the ancient Greeks loved stripping off, didn't they? Famously for the Olympics, all the athletes...
Yeah.
in the ancient Olympics competed in the nude. And that's where we get the words gymnasium and gymnastics from, which comes from the Greek word gymnosis, which means naked. And I always found it interesting because the German word for grammar school is gymnasium, which I always thought was a bit off.
Yes, it's a bit weird. Yeah. So male nudity was celebrated to a greater degree than in pretty much any culture before or since. One Greek poet suggested that farmers should sow naked, plow naked and harvest naked if you wish to bring God's fruits in due season.
Oh, sorry, John, I've drifted off a bit there. It's a sort of rural ancient Diet Coke break going on in my head.
So, yeah, nudity became a ritual costume associated with the power of the gods.
And Spartan women would sometimes be naked in public processions and festivals, but it was the naked male form that was held up as this holy ideal. Different times, John. Different times.
Different times. I think with that image in our head, we should take our first break and before we find out whether the Romans really kept their togas on at toga parties. See you after this. Welcome back. We're talking about nakedness and nudity throughout the centuries. We've got to the Romans, Angela. Yeah. They had very different ideas.
Well, we had to get there, didn't we, John? Because you're a man, and if memes on TikTok are to be believed, you think about the Roman Empire about once every 3 minutes.
This is about the 10th time today I've thought about the Romans. While homosexuality had been celebrated by the Greeks, Romans and Jews had been much less tolerant, and the Romans were actually paranoid about effeminacy, and so admiring the naked male form was frowned upon. The Roman poet Ennius declared, exposing naked bodies among citizens is the beginning of public disgrace.
We touched on this a bit in our history of swearing episode, I remember, about that sort of effeminacy and nakedness being insults.
Yeah.
And the Roman toga itself was a sort of symbol of the status of a Roman citizen, wasn't it? So the fact that their enemies, the Celts, would run into battle stark bollock naked, that was another reason for them to think of nudity as barbaric and vulgar and beneath them.
Yes.
So these negative connotations of nudity included defeat in war, since captives were stripped and sold into slavery. Slaves for sale were often displayed naked to allow buyers to inspect them for defects and symbolised that they lacked the right to control their own bodies. So there was all these negative associations with nudity and nakedness.
Yeah. But weirdly, Roman art regularly features nudity in mythological scenes, and sexually explicit art appeared on ordinary objects such as serving vessels, lamps and mirrors, as well as among the art collections of wealthy homes. It's a bit weird, isn't it, having porn on your dinner plates?
Yeah.
Oh, lovely new vase, lovely pictures. Yes, yes, we just got this from the antique market. Look, they're doing it doggy style on this side and reverse cowboy on the other side. It's really lovely.
Lovely. The only real exception to this disapproval in Roman society of public nudity was at the public baths, of course.
Yes.
Because you can't really bath with your clothes on, can you? Unless you're shrinking your jeans. Yeah. So early on in the Roman Empire, these bathhouses were exclusively for men, obviously.
Oh, here we go. I suppose that's sexist, is it?
Yeah. And then they had eventually two buildings, one for men and one for women. And the smaller one was usually for the women.
Oh, I suppose you're going to complain about that as well now, are you? Bloody hell, you've got your own bathhouse. You're still not satisfied. So later, men and women mixed at the baths, although it's not recorded how the women felt about this, gender-neutral bathhouses. I bet they were just trying to save building costs and dressing it all up as being progressive and modern.
Yeah, I can imagine there were some safety concerns there as well for Roman women in those places.
Yeah, quite sure, yeah. In fact, the Roman baths in Somerset were rebuilt after the fall of the Roman Empire. And they were used by both sexes without garments until the 15th century, which I thought was interesting.
Wow, that's, yeah, quite something.
Yeah. And although I always presumed it was much older, the Cern Abbas Giant probably dates from this post-Roman period.
So for those who don't know, that is the big figure cut into the chalky hillside in Dorset, which features a 55-metre-high naked man with a massive erect penis.
Yeah, in case you're interested, his penis is 11 metres long, including the testicles, which sort of feels like it's cheating.
You can't include the testicles in the measurement, John.
Well, that's what the internet told me. Nobody's quite sure whose idea it was to carve a massive erect penis into the side of an English hill. Maybe it was some drunken students in Ragwick, but because it's old and historic, it's been allowed to remain. If it was a modern image, you could never be allowed to put a picture of a massive prick on public display.
Just on the side of a hill. It is weird, isn't it? Yeah. Well, unless it was a poster of Johnny Depp advertising perfume, of course, then that massive prick could go anywhere.
Yeah. In the Middle Ages, it seems like it was acceptable to appear naked together. We have pictures of communal bathing, ceremonies in which naked bodies parade at festivals. And of course, most of the population lived in very close quarters, so nakedness was often a practical necessity.
Yeah, I guess when you're all, you know, your massive family's all in one room, you can't, modesty goes out the window, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. However, by contrast, there is a record from the 1400s, at the same time, of a maid being prosecuted for spying on her mistress as she disrobed. So it's that sort of two levels of society again, is it? It's fine for the common people to be naked and cavorting about together and, you know, but the rich could never be revealed as being the same as the rest of us. They can't be vulnerable or ordinary. Their fine clothes give them status, and that's what sets them apart from the peasants running around with the bollocks out. Yeah.
Yes, thank you for that nice image, Angela.
You're welcome.
Clothes were also expensive, of course, so if people were working in the fields in the midday sun, peasants would strip right down to the bare minimum rather than be hot and also rather than get their woolly vest ripped by all the brambles and everything.
Yeah, and this is, of course, why a suntan was so unfashionable back in that historical period, John, that we know as the olden days.
We're experts, yeah.
I can't believe people don't think we're real historians. Weird, isn't it? But it was never fashionable till recent times, was it, to have a tan? Because it showed that you had to work, you had to be outdoors, whereas pale skin meant you were privileged enough to be indoors all day.
Yeah, quite. Today it's the opposite, obviously. A tan now means you can afford to fly to the Maldives. Pallid white skin means you sat on your sofa all day watching Jeremy Carl.
Well, that's a nice current reference there, John. I think there's been a whole pandemic since Jeremy Kyle was last on the screen. Sure.
That's the last time I watched daytime TV. I'm sorry.
So there were parts of Europe where it was traditional to go naked to encourage crops to grow. It's part of the sort of folklore of particularly flax, apparently, which is the main crop used for making clothes, ironically, to cover the body.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's any coincidence. I think it's part of the psychology of it. In parts of Germany, women would wander naked in the flax fields on St. John's night and urinate in the flax fields, urging the crops to grow as high as their breasts.
Wow.
Whereas in Transylvania, men would walk naked through the flax fields, chanting, "Flax, flax, grow as high as the scrotum."
Not quite as ambitious in Transylvania.
No. I mean, yeah. Breast height, okay. Scrotum high, frankly, a bit disappointing if you're used to breast height. I think these measures have all gone out the window since decimalisation, if I'm honest.
So in Christian Europe, the parts of the body that were required to be covered in public didn't always include the female breasts. They weren't always seen as rude, I suppose. Yes, rude. For example, in depictions of the Madonna from the 14th century, Mary is often shown with one bared breast, which is symbolic of nourishment and loving care. I mean, I'd argue that one bared breast is weirder than both, but, you know, somehow it just is, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, that's the Madonna we're talking about, not Madonna. She comes much later.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Middle East, the wearing of veils by women predates Islam. And in fact, there are no strict rulings about the dress of women in the Quran. Originally, veiling only applied to the wives of Muhammad. And then it was adopted by upper class women after his death and became a symbol of Muslim identity. And as the Byzantine Empire was conquered by the Ottoman Empire, the Roman baths were kept in use, but mixed bathing was halted and Muslim women could not appear naked in the company of non-Muslim women. Meanwhile, in Europe, public attitudes to nudity were, of course, set by the church.
Of course.
Yeah, even though some pagan habits lived on, Angela, through traditions and a bit of practicality.
Artists continued to produce images of the naked human form and the church continued to cover them up. There was a naked image of Eve that had a skirt painted on it centuries later. Michelangelo's statue of the risen Christ portrayed Jesus in the nude, but then after he died, they added a loincloth. Spoil sports.
Yeah, it is worth mentioning that Christ was originally portrayed naked on the cross, as was the habit in crucifixion. But as attitudes changed, they started to add a loincloth. It's political correctness gone mad, Angela.
Yes. Mind you, you could have done with a loincloth in that picture your ex-girlfriend painted, couldn't you?
Yeah, if she could have painted one on afterwards, I would have appreciated it. Then when the Renaissance came along, it helped shift attitudes a bit as they rediscovered the art and writings of ancient Greece. And that offered an alternative tradition of nudity as symbolic of innocence and purity, which could be understood in terms of the state of man before the fall.
And attitudes to nudity in Europe were also affected in the 1500s by reports of naked inhabitants in the Americas and the African slaves brought initially by the Portuguese.
Yeah.
Female slaves were naked when purchased and then would be clothed and baptised by their new owners, which just so hypocritical, isn't it? Both slavery and colonialism were the beginning of this modern association of nakedness with what they would have called savagery.
Yeah. Then the Reformation comes along and people got really prudish. I mean, the Puritans were not like, hey, everyone, let's strip off, skinny dipping, get the sun to your naked body. It's so natural and healthy.
Oh, bloody Puritans have got so much to answer for. There's virtually no English laws mentioning or banning nudity around this period, which suggests it wasn't an issue. It probably came under common law, but the social conservatism of the age was dictated by the church anyway. So, you know, and they would have frowned on nudity and people were frightened of the church. They probably didn't challenge it. They probably did as they were told.
Absolutely. And you can get a measure of the negative association of nudity from its association with witchcraft. Mm. It probably wasn't worth going skinny dipping with your friends if you risked being declared a witch. So whenever witchcraft was described, they always include salacious descriptions of them cavorting naked in the moonlight. Disgusting it was. Let me describe it a bit more so you can understand exactly how disgusting it was. All these naked young women were running around in the moonlight.
We've done episodes on, you know, the whole witch thing and how it was just a way for men to get off really on talking about women that weren't pure or it's pretty grim. Yeah. Slightly ironic as well that, yeah, if you were caught skinny dipping, you were then dipped again as a witch. but there you go. At the time of Shakespeare, of course, there would have been no question of any nudity on stage, however bawdy the language or sexually suggestive the text might have been. But that hasn't stopped naked performances of Shakespeare in the last century or so.
Yes, yes, yes. I saw more willies than I needed last time I saw King Lear, if I'm completely honest.
I went with my school when we were doing A-levels. We saw Peter Hall's famous 1994 production of Hamlet at the Gielgud, where Stephen Delane very famously got naked. And, of course, we were a load of grammar school girls who were sort of, how old would I have been then? 16. And we were obviously very chill about this full frontal nudity, very chill about it. Yeah.
Something to talk about on the way home. So during the Enlightenment, taboos against nudity continued to grow. And by the Victorian era, public nudity was considered obscene. In addition to beaches being segregated by gender, bathing machines were invented, and they were used to allow people who had changed into bathing attire to enter directly into the water.
Those things are insane, aren't they? To go to that much trouble just to avoid getting a glimpse of someone's kneecap. Like, just struggle under a towel like the rest of us do when we're at the beach. For goodness sake, building an entire big wooden cart to wheel down to the front. Jeez Louise.
Yeah, I mean, even when my dad was a kid in Ireland before the war, they had separate bathing areas in the sea in Galway for male and female. It's amazing, really.
You separate the sea. It's madness.
Yeah, I know. Victorians were insane about bare flesh. A glimpse of ankle was considered shocking. Remember my English teacher, you know, at school, saying that his grandmother covered up the legs of her dining room table because she thought it was a bit rude to reveal that much leg. I don't think he was joking.
God, even the loo roll covers had floor-length skirts, John, if you remember.
Oh, God, that's right.
So meanwhile, of course, if there were no women about, the Victorian men were swimming naked in the sea and having lots of jolly, healthy outdoor fun. It was all right for them, as long as they couldn't be seen by the delicate eyes of ladies. Meanwhile, these poor, delicate ladies are stuck in these boiling hot, long dresses with a million layers of petticoats. Absolutely sod that.
Yeah. Those society in general frowned about exposing too much flesh. In the coal mines, of course, the work was so hot and dirty that the men at the coal face and women and children who pulled the carts or whatever, they often stripped completely naked while they worked.
Yeah, some of the objections from the reformers at the time, trying to reform, you know, what was going on in the mines and in industry and stuff, they mentioned this nudity below ground as being one of their principal objections, like, oh, this is terrible. They might be encouraged to indulge in carnal lust. It's like, no, they're just taking their clothes off because it's hot and sweaty. Oh, yeah, nothing turns you on like 12 hours crawling on your hands and knees through coal dust, does it?
Oh, God, geez. Yeah. Weirdly, the Victorians still had naked paintings in their art galleries, though very idealized images of the female form. Famously, the artist John Ruskin first saw his wife Effie's naked body on their wedding night. He was so horrified, he thought she'd be completely hairless down there, that he failed to consummate the marriage, like ever, end of relationship. So let's take another break as we approach the 20th century when things start to take a very different turn.
Hello and welcome back to We Are History, where we are talking about everything nude, nuddy, naked. Oh, look, they've got no clothes on. So it's the end of the prudish Victorian period. And that's when we start to get the first organised nudist organisations.
Yes, now we could do a whole episode on nudism and the naturist movement in Britain, Germany, elsewhere. But I will just give you the bare essentials.
Oh, John, you're so pleased with yourself there, aren't you?
I'm wasted here, I tell you.
You really are.
Bare essentials, you get it?
I get it, John. The naked truth.
Very good.
So, yes, the first recorded organisation dedicated to being naked, the first in the Western world at least, was in British India, where a small group of officers formed the Fellowship of the Naked Trust.
Yes, they wanted to challenge the false shame of our bodies, and they believed the naked body is God's noblest work, and it is good for everyone to gaze upon such beauty freely.
For a start, John, I'm not sure about the naked body being God's finest work, if I'm honest.
Yes.
Like, if you were looking at some of the beautiful views in, say, the Lake District, and then some naked bloke came and stood in front of you, I'm not sure you'd say, oh, that's better. And also, you know, these guys were in British India, I think. Was that their noble aim, or was it just they were British people and they were hot?
That was probably it. It's probably a big part of it. But but all I'll say is, you know how I like to say British did it first. This predates the foundation of equivalent organisations in Germany. But isn't it always the way that Brits have the idea and the Germans go and do it much better than us?
They are good at that, it has to be said.
So the Fellowship of the Naked Trust movement was very short-lived. Maybe it's just nowhere to pin the badges, I don't know. But soon Germany was the country that took to nudism more than any other at the turn of the century.
Yes, Richard, or Ricard probably, Ungerwitter in 1906 published his best-selling book, Die Nacktheit, which means nakedness. And this launched a whole movement in Germany, which for a few decades looked like it was unstoppable. And this movement is called the FKK, John, the Freikörperkultur, yes, which just means free body, yes, culture. Yeah.
But do you know what happened, Angela? Do you know what stopped it?
Go on.
Nazis.
Yeah.
They spoiled everything, those guys, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, maybe stopping Germans being naked on the beach isn't the worst thing they did, but, you know, it's up there. And the Catholic Church in Germany had been very opposed to all this prancing around in the nuddy. So it was an easy way for Nazis to get their support, a bit like Trump and banning abortion. He doesn't care about the issue of abortion. It just helps get him more power, so he supports it. And we saw the Nazis, exactly, do that in our episode on the Glamour Boys. You know, they were, yeah, fine with homosexuality until that became a problem in the eyes of the, you know, needing votes or whatever. So
yeah, exactly, yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, nudism still had its supporters in other Western countries, of course. In 1924, the Sunshine League was launched in London's Piccadilly. I'm guessing they didn't all go naked there. H.G. Wells was a supporter, and George Bernard Shaw. But in this country, it did sort of get filed under harmless cranks. George Orwell famously wrote, "Socialism draws towards it with magnetic force every fruit juice drinker, nudist, sandal wearer, sex maniac, Quaker, nature cure, quack, pacifist and feminist in England." Thanks, George. Welcome to the Labour Party.
So he just invented the wokerati. Is that...
No, it's just like, I love the way you put feminist, yeah, and feminist and pacifist on those. It's like, okay, yeah, you know, nature cure quack. Okay, they're annoying. And yeah, maybe a nudist is like a bit eccentric, but feminist? Is that a really...
Pacifist, pretty, yeah.
Hey, mate, lighten up, George.
Yeah. So the spread of the movement in the UK included some areas that might not seem quite as appropriate today. For example, the headmistress of Pinehurst School in Heathfield, just down the road from where I am in Sussex here. It offered boarding facilities. For a start, it offered boarding facilities to boys and girls from the age of three. Imagine sending your three-year-old to a boarding school. That is, I mean, horrific.
That's posh people, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? From 3 to 12. And they announced that in their 26 acres, the children run around naked. And on days when it rained, wow, the children have an air and rain bath and thoroughly enjoy this. Do they thoroughly enjoy it? I remember when I started secondary school, being absolutely terrified that they were going to make us take showers together. And they didn't at our school.
Oh, I remember doing that.
But we didn't have to. But because their communal showers were there in the building,
yeah,
when we went on the open day and looked around, I was like, I don't want to go there.
Wow.
Like, kids are, you know, shy of their...
Yeah, self-conscious. We used to have communal with boys' showers. I hated it.
Oh, God.
I was very late to puberty, so I remember thinking, oh, no, don't make me go in there. I'm so embarrassed.
Yeah, well, I've seen that painting of you, John. I'm not surprised.
Yeah, exactly. That's really late, yeah. Oh, dear. It seems that naturism was quite a middle-class pursuit, I should say. Mm. Whereas the posh men, of course, had never worried too much about being seen naked by their servants. When Churchill was staying with Roosevelt, the American president came to visit Winston in his rooms and found Winston stark naked, dictating something to his assistant. So FDR beats this hasty retreat, and Churchill calls him back and says, "The British Prime Minister has nothing to hide from the American president."
Didn't Churchill...
Can you imagine it?
...conduct quite a lot of meetings and things from the bath? I'm pretty sure,
yes,
that's a, yeah. So he was obviously not bothered about, and actually, that's a bit of power play as well, isn't it? That's a bit of a...
I think so. You know. Oh, maybe it is. Yeah, yeah.
So in 1934, God, we saw the launch of the magazine Health and Deficiency. And this featured black, yes, and white photos of people in nudist camps of all shapes and sizes and ages and usually, yes, playing ping, yes, pong or volleyball.
Oh, exactly. I actually remember this magazine used to get passed around at school, and it was the first magazine to show pubic hair shot, wow, fire. But of course, immediately afterwards, all the porn mags followed suit. So before 1969, Playboy and Penthouse and all those mags would drape a bit of cloth around a woman's groin, or a sudden mist would descend, or a large houseplant would happen to be in the way. But by the time the 1960s come along, being naked was all part of being modern and unsquare and rejecting the stuffy Victorian prudery that had sort of emotionally crippled generations before.
Yeah, so there's these lucky young secretaries at the White House who are encouraged to go skinny dipping with JFK. in the White House pool, and sometimes Bobby and Teddy would join them, and they're probably just interested in their views on national security, and there was nothing wrong or weird with that.
I'm sure. I mean, the 60s were supposedly the death of shame, and that's the title of the relevant chapter in Philip Carr Gomm's book. But, you know, as so often when we talk about the 60s, that doesn't apply to everyone.
Yeah, there's that subculture, isn't it, really, of hippies who embrace nudity and danced in the mud at Woodstock or the Isle of Wight Festival, and topless sunbathing became fashionable in the south of France. But your average, you know, woman working in the typing pool and going on holiday to Blackpool wasn't getting her bits out for the lads.
I mean, the rest of the world was taking a while to catch up. I've got this strong memory of being on holiday in Italy. It must have been the late 60s. I was quite young. And I was walking into town with my dad on this scorching summer's day. And my dad was just in shorts with a bare chest. And he got stopped by a policeman who came across blowing his whistle and told my dad to cover himself up or he'd arrest him.
Wow, just for having his chest?
Yeah, for a man with his bare chest. So dad went into a shop and bought a shirt.
Oh,
and
wow.
And that was, you know, amazing, isn't it? Men had been arrested for being bare-chested on the beach in America in the 1930s. And it was, not to the end of the 30s, it was legal to be bare-chested on a beach in America.
Well, I think we should bring that back. I live in Brighton. Yes, and honestly, as soon as the sun gets out down here on the beach, I would happily bring that rule back. No, I don't mean that. All bodies are beautiful and some are slightly more beautiful than others.
Some are more beautiful than others.
So in the late 1960s, nudity was finally permissible on the stage. So you might remember in our episode we did on the Profumo affair, nudity was only permissible in a frozen tableau in a theatre. But this all changed in 1968. And there was the famous musical Hair, in which the cast appeared completely naked, but not for very long. Blink and you miss it. It was so brief and the lighting was so dim that the comedian Jack Benny was heard asking, "Did you happen to notice if any of them were Jewish?"
In the early 1970s, there was a craze for streaking that I remember reaching its peak when I was about 12, and people would run naked through public places or at sports events. There was even this novelty hit about it, I remember. It was like, "Oh, yes, they call him the streak, boogity, boogity. He likes to show off his physique. Don't look, Ethel." You probably don't remember that.
I don't. I'm too young, John. But I remember the phenomenon of streaking was a really big thing, wasn't it? And Britain's streaker at Twickenham produced that famous photograph with a couple of policemen apprehending him and one of them using his helmet to cover up the modesty of the streaker.
Yes. That copper was called Bruce Perry and he said it was cold. He didn't have anything to be proud of. The streaker had been bet 10 quid that he wouldn't make it across the pitch to touch the other side. And when he told the policeman that, the copper let him touch the advertising hoarding, so he won his bet.
Brilliant.
But the magistrate fined him the same amount on the Monday morning. And that helmet is now on display at the Twickenham Rugby Museum.
Oh, I like that he broke even, though. I think that's quite nice.
Yeah.
And since those days, it seems like nudity has pretty much lost its power to shock. You might have heard of the puppetry of the penis show. I mean, that was in the 90s that started. I remember that taking the Edinburgh Festival by storm when I was going up there in the 90s. Not that I ever watched it. I did meet one of them in a bar once, and he was sort of had it out and doing these tricks in the bar, and I thought
in the bar,
yeah, I was like,
that's just indecent exposure.
Yeah, he did do one called the hamburger, and it really put me off my pint.
Well, so so nudity now is like, you know, you see it on television. My American co-writer and his wife, they were watching British TV when they were over here, and they were like, "What the hell is this show, Naked Attraction? You would never get that in the USA." It's insane.
No. Oh, it's weird as well. There's no pubic hair on it. It's really disturbing.
I've never watched it, Angela. I don't know. I don't record it. Yeah, it's not on my series link.
Yeah, all right. I believe you.
And yet, on the other side of the coin, the Sun have been pressurised and ceased publication of the Daily Page 3 Girl.
Well, rightly so. You know, it's not an expression of their, you know, right to be naked in public places. It's purely for the titillation of men, isn't it, that?
Yes. Exactly. So we're sort of, as progressive people would say, people have the right to be naked on the beach if they want, but don't serve up young women's breasts for men's pleasure, you know, on a daily basis as a disposable item.
Yeah, just as without anyone asking for it, without any, you know, it's just, it was so base and must have made us look absolutely insane in other countries.
It did. They did. They were like, they're newspapers. You'd hear American stand-ups talk about it. You open the paper and whoa, it's like, what's that? Yeah. It's sort of bizarre, really, look back about it.
But that sort of comes out of that repressed Victorian stuff, like we talked about with saucy postcards and all of that, you know, British smut thing from the 20th century. Yes. There was a real hangover from the reaction to the Victorians, wasn't it? And we just got it really wrong.
Yeah. But nakedness is now much more sort of tolerated and accepted.
Yeah.
Didn't you do some event once?
Yeah. So in July, it's only a couple of months ago from when we're recording this, I took part in a naturist comedy. I'll tell you the story, John. So I got an email.
A naturist comedy event?
Yeah. I got an email from my agent and the subject line said, "You have to do this for the lols." And my first thought was, well, lols don't pay my mortgage, so I'll probably do it for that if the money's all right. And I opened it, and it was, so there's an event called Nude Fest. They do this week-long festival in Somerset on a campsite in Somerset, and they put on entertainment on different nights. So one of the nights they put on a comedy night, and I was asked if I wanted to come and headline it. And actually, my dad was a naturist, and so naturism is something I, you know, understand a little bit about, although I'm not a naturist. And so I said, yeah, I'll come and do that. And the proviso was that we, the comedians on stage, got to be clothed.
That's what everyone listening is
wondering.
That's what everyone is thinking. They're sitting there waiting for you to go, is she wearing clothes or not? Get to that bit.
So we had the option, like, could have gone naked, and we could, and do you know what?
Right.
I would have done, only that it only takes one person to take a photo and then that goes on Twitter or whatever. Yep. And when you've got a little bit of public profile, you know, out of context, I don't want my picture anywhere. So that was the only reason I didn't. But the naturists themselves, the night was incredible. And I've got a brilliant photo of it that we'll tweet out when this episode goes out of me on stage.
Oh my God, not too graphic, I hope.
It's not, no, it's not. And it's hard to explain the philosophy of it, but it was such a warm, welcoming place. There was some weird things. So I arrived, I sort of drove onto the campsite, and in my head, I was sort of giving myself the little talk going, you know, right, everyone's going to be naked. Don't be British about this. Like, you know, just nothing to see here, you know, just kind of try and... But what really shocked me, or not shocked, but surprised me maybe, was that I got there, the show was about 8 o'clock in the evening. It was in July. And so started to get a little cool in the evening. And so people were putting on tops to kind of, you know, because it was chilly.
Right.
But they weren't covering the bottom. So I was having these conversations with these men that were wearing T-shirts, but they'd sort of gone for the Winnie the Pooh approach. Like,
naked for the waist.
And that was weirder somehow than them being fully naked.
Yeah, so completely naked.
Like talking to these giant toddlers was what it felt like.
Oh, God.
I did the show, and the show was absolutely brilliant. Like, they were really, and they were quite happy to take, you know, because it was a weird feeling to be the only clothed person in a room and somehow you're the weird one. You know, you're the pervert. Somehow she felt a bit voyeuristic. But they were very sweet, and they were able to take jokes. But like at one point, these two women got up to go to the toilet, and I said, okay, no more than two at a time, otherwise I'll think I'm getting a round of applause, you know, and things like that. And then
that's a funny joke.
Yeah, thanks. And there was one point where I have a routine about how I always get food down myself when I'm eating. And I was just doing that routine. Right. And I was like, oh, suddenly your way of life makes sense to me. Like, just do away with clothes and I won't get my food down myself. And this woman shouted out, take your clothes off. And I was like, well, in any other comedy club, in that would get you removed, shouting that at me on stage.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Like, but in this room, I was like, in that moment, I almost did it. And it was only because of that fear of someone taking a photo and putting it somewhere else. But in that room,
yes,
I felt completely safe to have done it. I would have felt completely empowered, and it was such a wonderful thing. And then at the end of the show, John, this is the funny bit, they gave me a standing ovation and I will never unsee it. Just sort of 500 naked men and women stood up and I was just, oh, my eyes.
That's too much. Stay sitting. You were still, that was better, but you're moving around now. That's a bit much.
But I did and I will tweet out a picture of this as well. I've got it here, but we haven't got the cameras on at the moment. there was a woman in the audience who came up to me afterwards, and she was a ceramicist. And she said, can I give you this? I really enjoyed your show, and I made this, and I want you to have it. And it's a little mug, and it's got gold-plated breasts on it. So that was my little gift lovely. I was given at the end of that
Fantastic.
Show. There you go.
That's great. Well, that's a good show. It's a very positive sort of conclusion to this episode. But, I mean, it has to be said, you know, naked stand-up gigs aside, 5,000 years after the Book of Genesis was written, it's still socially unacceptable to walk down the road naked.
Yeah.
But at least now you won't get burnt as a witch. So there we are. That's our long look at nudity, as it were.
You pervert.
Nobody died, Angela. There were no massacres, no wars, no torture, no famines or plagues. Unfortunately, the search history of my computer is now all nudity, nudes, naked, naturism, nudism.
You say that like it wasn't like that before you researched this podcast, John.
Oh, I walked into that one.
So if you feel like giving us a rating on Apple Podcasts, I think 5 stars is our favourite one, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I love that one.
By the way, I'm not talking about to go straight from nudity to asking for reviews is, I mean, ratings on the podcast. Let me make that clear.
Yes, yes.
You can, of course, follow us on social media, Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it. Insta, which is my favorite because it's just nicer than the others. So that's at We Are History Pod on both of those. Or if you're John on MySpace, he's the only one left on there, him and Tom. It's quite sweet, really.
I read about it on CFAX.
Thank you to all of our Patreon supporters.
Oh, Angela, I've got a special one I read out. Can I read out one, a special one that we got?
Oh, yes, please do. Yeah.
Yeah, it says, hi, John and Angela. My wife and I love your podcast and wanted to let you know that subscribing to your Patreon today was our 21st wedding anniversary present to each other, as we always listen to the podcast together. Isn't that nice? It's a bit cheeky, but could you maybe give a shout out to our friend CF, who also loves it? All the best, Storm and Ali.
Hello, Storm and Ali, and your friend CF. And I mean, that's lovely that you bought us as an anniversary present, but if my husband did that, I'd leave him. But yeah, that's that's lovely. Thank you so much. And we've got some other Patreon shout outs to do. So let's say hello to Rachel Blanchard,
Tony Eagleston,
Holly Fegan,
Colin,
and Dunstan Vavasour. I'm hoping I've got that right. If you want to join our Patreon, it's patreon.com/wearehistory, and you get all sorts of perks and bits and bobs, exclusive episodes, merchandise. The link will be in the show notes.
And you help us make this show, so thank you very much. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Put your clothes on, John. Bye.
Oh, God, I'm freezing. I'm putting something on.
We Are History is written and presented by Angela Barnes and John O'Farrell, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The lead producer is Anne-Marie Luff, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison, with artwork by James Parrott. We Are History is a Podmasters production.